Next case on our calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Gibson. Thank you. Good morning. Next case is State versus Gibson. While you are getting settled, I'll remind both attorneys that you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument because they are being recorded. The timing, we usually come with a clock. We didn't for whatever reason today. So we will be keeping track of time the old-fashioned way. You will see a sign when you have 5 minutes left and then another sign when you have 1 minute left and then stop means stop. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you are ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the appellant State of Minnesota in this state's pretrial appeal. This case turns on a question of statutory interpretation. Does Minnesota Statute Section 16930 Parens B require a driver to stop at the stop sign or clearly marked stop line, or rather to simply stop at some unspecified location before entering the intersection? The district court held that despite the fact that the statute says the driver of the vehicle shall stop at the stop sign or clearly marked stop line, a driver does not violate the statute so long as he stops before entering the intersection. The district court was wrong for three reasons.
Go ahead.
I'm certainly, Judge Smith, if you want to ask a question, I'm ready now.
It seems like it all comes down to what the word at means.
I think that's more or less what this case boils down to. It also, in addition to what at means, it also depends upon the grammatical structure of the statute and what the phrase before entering the intersection does in the statute. And you have to read those two things together to figure out the command of the statute.
And would you agree that a stoplight is equivalent to a stop sign?
I would agree that they have the functional equivalent of commanding a driver to stop. They're governed by two different statutes, so I think that's important to bear in
mind. It does say you have to stop at a stoplight.
No, the statute doesn't say you have to stop at the stoplight. 169, I think it's 06 subdivision 5, says you have to stop at the stoplight, or at the stop line when the intersection is
if they're smart.
Yeah, I think the statute envisions only three options for the stop light situation. It says that the driver has to stop at the stop line, or if there's no stop line, at as close as practicable, I think, to the entrance of the crosswalk on the near side of the intersection, or if there's no crosswalk, then at the intersection, at the entrance to the intersection. So there's three options in 16906.
That's for stop lights.
That's for stop lights.
Which we don't have here.
Which we don't have here. So what we have here is a different statute in a different situation. The statute says you have to stop at the stop line, at the stop sign, or the clearly marked stop line.
Did Mr. Gibson stop either at the stop sign or at the stop line?
He did not. He stopped, to the extent that he stopped his vehicle, the entire length of his vehicle was past the stop sign and the stop line. The stop sign and the stop line are in a perpendicular line at this particular intersection.
And that fact is undisputed?
That fact is undisputed, that he stopped completely past the stop sign and the stop line. There's no question about that. In the SWAT video, if the court has the opportunity to watch it, it's very clear on that fact.
So it was approximately a car length past, is that right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, the entire length of the car was completely past the stop line and the stop sign.
But he hadn't entered the intersection?
He had not entered the intersection, that's correct. The district court here is wrong for three reasons. First, the plain and ordinary meaning of the words of this statute in context and the basic rules of grammar don't support the district court's interpretation. Second, the district court's interpretation of the statute renders the language at the stop sign or clearly marked stop line surplusage. And third and finally, Bonham v. Gore does not support the district court's interpretation of the statute, because insofar as Bonham interpreted any statute, it interpreted section 16920 subdivision 3, which governs not stopping at stop signs, but stopping at the entrance to through highways. Because the plain and unambiguous language of section 16930 requires a driver to stop his vehicle at the stop sign or clearly marked stop line, respondent violated the statute when he stopped his car completely past the stop sign and stop line before entering the intersection.
So what does at mean?
At means, the dictionary definition that best applies here is in or near the location of. And I think
so if someone goes past the stop sign by 2 feet, have they violated the statute?
I think there's a reasonable argument that they have violated the statute, but the court doesn't need to reach that question in this case because here we have a vehicle that's stopped completely past the stop line and the stop sign. You don't have to answer that question here. A narrow ruling would certainly eliminate that possibility. But I think to the extent that the dictionary definition here is not maybe as clear as we'd like it to be, a consideration of how we use at in ordinary life really helps focus in on what the plain and ordinary meaning of the word at is. We don't need to be absolutely slaves to the dictionary. The dictionary is just one place we can turn for the plain and ordinary meaning of a word. And I would submit that at any time we use at in reference to a line in ordinary life, it means in front. If you're at the edge of the Grand Canyon, you are in front of the edge. If you go beyond the edge, well, you're probably dead. If you're at the goal line in a football game, you're in front of the goal line. You're not in the end zone. Once you go beyond the goal line, you're no longer at the goal line. You're in the end zone. The same thing applies in basketball. If you're at the free throw line, you have to be in front of it. You can't be beyond it.
But what about when you're at the store?
And that's a different usage of at.
Okay.
And the dictionaries do make distinctions between the general location, like going to the market or being at the market or at the store, as opposed to a reference to a particular point.
Or a particular time. At 10 o'clock
right.
Would be not 10:01 and would not be 9:59.
Correct.
So context of when at is used.
Exactly, and that's my point here. This context is the use of at with reference to a very specific point or line. And we know that at has to be the spatial reference in this statute for a couple of reasons. First of all, at is used with reference to nots, to locations. Before, the other preposition here, is used with a gerund, a verb. It's before doing an act. That tells us that that's a temporal reference, the time at which you have to stop, not the location. So reading the statute where at specifies the location, the where you have to do the act, and before specifies the when, the time at which you have to do the act, gives effect to all of the provisions of the statute and doesn't render any of them surplusage. And I think that's, that moves into the second reason why the district court was wrong here. And that's the district court's reading of this statute effectively crosses at a stop sign or a clearly marked stop line out. It doesn't matter. In the, under the district court's interpretation, that phrase doesn't do any work in this statute. And that's not consistent with the unpublished decision of this court in Marlium. In Marlium, the defendant argued he stopped 30 feet before the stop sign, and that was good enough because he stopped before entering the intersection.
That had to do, the decision there had to do with the flow of traffic, and that was the basis of the decision there.
Well, that was part of the reasoning there, but it certainly was also backed up by the reading of the statute and the opinion in Bonin, and recognizing that Bonin stood for a limited proposition and it didn't interpret 169.30b. All that Bonin said about 169.30b, to the extent it said anything, is that compliance with 169.30b may not be sufficient to comply with 169.20 subdivision 3.
Or a driver's overall duty to maintain a proper lookout and avoid it. I mean, correct. That's a tort action that seems to me very different.
Exactly. The ultimate question there was whether the plaintiff had complied with their duty of care at that intersection. And it's important to remember that merely satisfying statutory duties may never be enough to satisfy your civil duty of care. So the tendency to read Bonin as definitively interpreting 169.30b fails to account for, one, what Bonin actually said, and two, the context and the limited nature of the decision. In fact,
the Bonin court didn't address the issue that's before us today.
That's correct. Bonin did not address the issue that's before this court in this case. Quite frankly, there's no published authority that addresses the question that's before this court in this case today. I think that's part of the reason why we're here. The other thing about surplusage is that we should be mindful of the whole text canon here. We should be mindful of what 169.30 is about. 169.30A gives the Commissioner of Transportation and local road authorities the authority to designate through highways by erecting stop signs. Section 169.30B tells drivers what they must do when confronted with a stop sign so erected. It would make no sense to read 169.30b, the command portion of this statute governing driving conduct, to make the commissioner's effort in putting up stop signs or marking stop lines completely superfluous and unnecessary. And this is clearly one statute. We're talking about different clauses of the same statute. And so they have to be read together to make sense. Moreover, the district court's interpretation actually renders all of section 169.30b, even the command to stop before entering the intersection, surplusage. The entire statute is superfluous. If all 169.30b says is that you have to stop before entering the intersection, then it's coextensive with the command in section 169.20 subdivision 3, which already requires a driver to do just that. You must stop at the entrance to a through highway. To the extent that Bonin interprets any statute, it actually interprets section 169.20 subdivision 3, and it says that your stopping at the stop sign might not be enough to satisfy your duty under 169.20. So again, as the court I think has recognized, Bonin really doesn't answer the question presented here, and we're dealing for all intents and purposes with a question of first impression on a statute that quite plainly is not ambiguous. It's not susceptible to more than one reasonable interpretation, and the clear command of the statute should apply. And when this court applies that clear command of the statute to the undisputed facts of this case, it's clear that the officer had a lawful basis to stop the respondent's vehicle. Accordingly, the district court erred when it ruled that the stop of the respondent's vehicle was unlawful, and I would, for that reason, respectfully ask this court to reverse the decision of the district court and remand the matter to the district court for trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
which was his accord, opposing counsel. My name is Brittany Sandiger, and I represent the respondent, Mr. Daryl Gibson. I want to start off by addressing what the real intention and purpose of this statute is, because I feel like that was missing the appellate's argument. When we're looking at the traffic statute, the primary concern the legislature had when enacting these laws was safety. They wanted to make laws and rules and designate duties for drivers so that the thousands of drivers in Minnesota every day could actually follow what they needed to do when encountering these situations. When we're talking about 169.20 subdivision 3A and 30B, we're looking at two distinct statutes, but the overall goal is related to one another. They work together. And the purpose of this statute is to stop a vehicle so that they can actually see oncoming traffic before they move it into a through highway.
Well, that's clearly 169.20 seems to say that. It says even after you've stopped, you have to, because you were the one facing a stop sign, yield to the cross traffic. So, are you arguing that 169.30 suggests the same interpretation?
I believe it does, and I think that they work hand in hand together to accomplish this ultimate goal from the legislature, which is we need drivers to cautiously approach intersections. We need to try and limit the amount of accidents we have, because traffic on a thruway is probably traveling at a higher rate of speed than at another street in your town or your city.
But we also have to stop at stop signs. I mean, when there's a stop sign, everyone's supposed to stop at a stop sign.
And I think the court has acknowledged that the word "at" is what this comes down to. And the appellant acknowledges this. The word "at," its plain and ordinary meaning, is near the position of. And the court was concerned in this case about where the car was at.
Do you agree that the record is clear that this car was past the stop line approximately a car length?
I agree that when the car ultimately came to a complete and controlled stop, the back tires had just passed the stop sign and the stop line. But I think it's important to look at
The stop line or the stop sign?
It would be both, Your Honor. It'd be the clearly marked stop line and the stop sign, since they are perpendicular to one another.
There was a stop line there too?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think what's important here is what happened leading up to this. And unlike
Why? I mean, the statute says every driver shall stop at a stop sign or a clearly marked stop line before entering the intersection. So to comply with the statute, you have to stop at a stop sign or a stop line. So don't we look at where the vehicle was stopped?
And I think "at," that language means near the position of. So we're not in this issue of opposing counsel refuses to discuss with the court what happens if the front tires go over the line.
But in this case, looking at the facts of this case, how is a car that stopped past the stop line, a length of the car, at the stop line?
Because the statute instructs, and this is where it's crucial that the two statutes are combined for the overall goal, is that it's before the intersection. And that's what we want vehicles to do. And especially in this case, it's so important to know.
So if you're a full length past the stop line, you're still in compliance with the statute, as long as you're not in the intersection?
I believe so, yes. And that's what I would ask the court to adopt today, in compliance with the multiple Court of Appeals cases on this exact same issue and the Supreme Court in Bonner v. Gore.
Okay, let's talk about Bonner. I have a really hard time, frankly, with some of the way our court and unpublished decisions have looked at Bonner, which in my mind is a tort action where the district, where the plaintiff in that case is seeking to make arguments about negligence based on traffic statutes. And we know that failure to comply with the traffic statute is indicative of negligence. It's negligence per se. But in Bonner, the argument was went beyond that. In Bonner, you had compliance with the stop, as I understand it, but you had someone enter an intersection without yielding to the oncoming traffic. And I think what the Bonner court said was that compliance with the statute is not in and of itself determinative of negligence, that you can be negligent under tort law even if you comply with all these statutes. Am I reading Bonner wrong?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think it's important that the court note the language in the body of this decision, that stop signs provide an opportunity for motorists to stop.
That's not what the law says. The law says the vehicle shall stop at a stop sign.
And Bonin addressed 169. They specifically cited to the statute and 169.20 subdivision 3A. And when looking at those statutes, the court makes a decision on those statutes, because 169.20 subdivision 8 does not discuss stop signs. So the court was specifically discussing 169.30 sub B. And so that court discussed this issue. They made a determination. They analyzed these statutes. And while they determined negligence as a part of that group case, they still made a determination. It's not just dicta, as the appellant would have you believe.
What language, can you point me to the language in Bonin that you're relying on to say that they decided the issue?
It would be at 464. And it says also that it may not be sufficient to stop where the sign is erected in order to comply with the statute. And the courts touched basis on that, I think, a couple times. And I think it's important to note that 169.20 subdivision 3A, as cited by the court, contains no language about stop signs. So they were specifically speaking of the duty to stop at a stop sign.
Well, now 169.20 subdivision 3 is very clear. You stop at the stop sign or stop line. You have to do that before you enter the intersection, right?
And that's where that becomes important, because here we have someone stopping near the stop sign.
Okay, there's a different, I'm really struggling with this, you can tell, so maybe you can help me. I mean, there's also a statute that says you have to stop at a marked crosswalk when people are in it. If you're in the marked crosswalk, I drive halfway in and strike you. If I stopped at it because I've entered it and the front part of my vehicle runs into you, would you argue that I had stopped at the marked crosswalk?
And that's a different statute. And in those statutes, they clearly state that you need to stop on the near side or before the entrance of. Here we have no crosswalk, no pedestrians, no sidewalks. So there's different laws associated with the concerns of safety for pedestrians. Here, the idea is we want someone to be able to slowly approach an intersection and view oncoming traffic. In cases like Marlene, say the closer you are, the easier it is for you to see. We want people to be as close as possible to the stop sign and the intersection. So this isn't 30 feet away from the stop sign. This isn't 10 feet. And when you watch the DVD...
When are you no longer near the stop line? If we interpret at to mean near, as you're suggesting, on either side of the line, when are you no longer near?
I would argue that in the cases where you're 30 feet, 10 feet away, you're not near. Here, he slowly approached the stop sign, and it's important the officer testified at that location you cannot observe oncoming traffic. I took the same exit this morning before I came in. You cannot see traffic safely coming.
So does that obviate the need to stop at the stop? So why even have a stop sign there?
I think it's what Bonin said and what other courts since this case have said. Most recently in Holm v. Commissioner of Public Safety, it's to afford motorists the opportunity to start slowing down before they reach the intersection.
But if that was the intent, wouldn't the legislature have said that? That's what I'm struggling with. I mean, we look to the language of the statute. And even if the legislature had some other broader intent, if the language of the statute is clear, we apply the language of the statute. And it doesn't say opportunity, it says shall stop.
At. They did not decide to say on the near side or directly before the stop line. Had they wanted a motorist to not put one wheel or one tire or one bumper over that line, they would have said the same as they did with the crosswalk statute and the stop sign statutes, that you have to stop on the near side. They didn't say that. And I think when you're going home today and watching cars, what you're going to see is people stop where they can see traffic coming, and that is oftentimes past that line.
But don't they usually first stop at the stop sign and then go forward to see if it's safe to turn into the highway that has more traffic?
I think Bonin would instruct that when you're looking at a stop sign where the obstruction is, you can't see oncoming traffic, you move to a place where you can actually see, and then you complete the stop. And that's exactly what happened here. The respondent's actions were completely reasonable given the obstructed view at that stop sign. He had to move forward. He completed a complete stop. That's what we want our drivers to do here. And that's why I believe the Supreme Court says it's not sufficient just to stop at a stop sign and call it a day. Yes, you might have to make an additional stop if you choose to do that.
But in the context of negligence, though.
Correct. That was the initial framework, but they still spent the majority of this decision discussing the rules for stop signs and through highways. And that's how they come to the conclusion, ultimately, that this person acted negligently. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that I believe that this case is a part of an overall problem in Minnesota with pretextual stops. And I believe that if the court supports the appellant's argument, this is only further providing support and opportunity for law enforcement to complete seizures and vehicle searches on minor and petty traffic.
Well, let me stop you there. I mean, that when you make an argument about pretext, it's a serious argument. I don't think there's a dispute as the facts here. The dispute is whether the facts indicate a violation of a traffic statute, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, so there's no dispute about what the officer observed or didn't observe.
Correct.
Okay.
I just pointed out because it is another concern in the case, and I think it goes to the overall purpose of why this stop happened in the first place. It wasn't because it was a violation of traffic law. It wasn't. The respondent acted in accordance with this statute. He acted reasonably and with due care, and that's obvious when you watch the DVD. I think that that's just another reason why these stops occur. It wasn't because he acted in an unreasonable manner. He didn't come to a, staggering stop. He didn't slam on his brakes. He slowly approached the stop sign, slowly crossed over, completed a complete stop at a place where he could view oncoming traffic. And so I think at means near. I think it comes to a case-by-case decision of where at is, near is, in relation to what's going on at that particular intersection.
Under your interpretation of the law, what would driver's education classes teach students about how to comply with this law?
I believe it would be safety is our primary goal always. And if you can't safely observe something, I think the idea is that you need to approach intersections slowly and cautiously in mind not only other traffic in front and behind you, but I would argue that they would not say you have to stop. You make sure your bumper does not cross that line, because it's arbitrary. That's not what prevents accidents. What prevents accidents is people using caution and common sense when they come to an intersection so that they can see who's coming. And I think if we get hung up on you have to stop directly before this line, people aren't going to be focusing on what's around them. They're going to be looking at the line throughout. And that's not what legislature intended. They wanted people to be aware of their surroundings and yet still be mindful that an intersection and high-speed vehicles are approaching.
Are you arguing that the statute is ambiguous?
No, I believe it is clear, and it's been clear since 1951. There's been 68 years that this case has been litigated. Every 10 years or so, this case become an issue again. And every time, the Court of Appeals says, the duty is to stop before the intersection. Nothing has changed since then. Legislature amended the statute one time in 1961 and changed none of the material operative language. The duty to stop is still at the stop sign or the lock. You have to stop before the intersection. None of those things changed, and it hasn't changed since 1961. And I think I'd ask the court to uphold the ruling in the district court and find that that duty still exists, that you have to stop before an intersection. I'd ask the court to look at the overwhelming history on this issue, the legislature's intention, and also the plain and ordinary meaning of this statute. When you look at the definition of that, the appellant comes out of thin air and says, that means directly before.
What about appellant's argument that your interpretation renders a portion of the language of the statute meaningless?
I don't think it does. I think what it does is it tells us we have to observe these stop signs and stop at them when reasonable to do so. But what the overarching theme is that we need to stop before the intersection. It has to be a clear stop, and it has to be near in relation to the stop sign, because otherwise you get cases like Marlene, where you're stopping 30 feet away. That's not what legislature interpreted that statute to mean. We want people to be near that area, and if you need to pull ahead and stop again, you might need to. That's what they want here. There's no case law, nothing I'm aware of that says you need to stop directly in front of this line. That's not what legislature intended. They want people to be observing traffic.
Perfect timing. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to point out that respondents' proposed interpretation of the statute and the district court's holding, well, I think really respondents' proposed interpretation actually introduces ambiguity into an otherwise plain and unambiguous statute. As Judge Cochran pointed out, I don't know how you would instruct new drivers in driver's education to comply with the statute as read by a respondent. But I think there's an easy way to instruct drivers that complies with all of our statutes. It's really easy to construe 16930B and 16920 subdivision 3A and even Bonham, the civil tort duty of care, together. And it goes like this. When you approach a stop sign or a clearly marked stop line, you must first stop there. If you cannot safely observe traffic from that vantage point, you must slowly proceed to a place where you can before entering the intersection, thereby complying with 16920 subdivision 3.
Wouldn't the statute, if it was written that way, be clear?
Well, certainly.
But it's not written that way.
No, the statute 16930 is not written that way. But respondent is suggesting that you have to read the statutes together. I reject that here because the statute in question is not plain, is not ambiguous, and therefore we have to rest our decision on the plain text of the statute. But if we were to conclude there's ambiguity, then we can read these statutes in pari materia. I would concede that the statutes are in pari materia, 16930B and 16920 subdivision 3A.
Doesn't the subdivision B and 169.30, the first part of that refers to the designation of through highways.
Correct.
So wasn't that intended to show that a point at which the highways intersect as being the important issue?
It certainly is. But then it specifies a method by which the commissioner or the local road authority controls the flow of traffic at those intersections. It's by erecting stop signs and painting stop lines. And then it commands drivers to comply with those stop signs or stop lines.
Why isn't the statute written before the stop sign then? That's the trouble I'm having, because they always get to add.
Sure. And I think what the reason that the statute's not written that way is because the legislature chose to use before as a temporal preposition describing before entering the intersection, and using before the stop sign, one I think would be more ambiguous than at. It would suggest that the result in Marleyan was sufficient. I have a footnote in my brief that kind of is a reduction to the absurd, but if the command is only to stop before entering the intersection, is it enough that you stop at the rest area in Beaver Creek on Interstate 90 and continue driving continuously, assuming you don't have to refuel, and keep going through the first controlled intersection you encounter after I-35 in Duluth?
But we have a case that dispels that notion, right?
Well, I'm not sure what case that would be.
What's the name of that one? Doesn't that, what, the 30-foot case? I mean, that's Marleyan.
But that's an unpublished decision.
Right, it's unpublished.
And it says that before doesn't work.
Right.
So I think that's a good indication of why the legislature chose that.
Why didn't the legislature say instruct to stop on the near side of the stop sign or stop line?
That's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Because the line and the stop sign don't have sides like a crosswalk does. A crosswalk has two sides. It has the near side and the far side. It occupies space. A line doesn't. So I think that's the simple answer and pretty straightforward answer there. There's no near or far side. That wouldn't make sense in this context. And therefore, the use of the word at, especially as we understand it in everyday life, when we're dealing with lines, makes perfect sense here. There's no ambiguity. You know where you have to stop. And you can comply with both statutes. They're not irreconcilable, and so they have to each be given their independent meaning and effect. The legislature has made it abundantly clear that the courts are required to read the statutes in that way. That's codified in Minnesota Statute 645, I think it's 17. My time's up.
All right, thank you. Thank you both, counsel. Really well argued and presented to the court. We appreciate that. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period. Thank you. And that's the last case on our calendar for oral arguments, so we are in recess.